Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Tunisia, where there is an uneasy calm on the streets following the departure of the dictator Ben Ali. We'll be joined by Blake Hounshell, who is the managing editor of Foreign Policy and is an Arab-speaking expert who is in Doha, Qatar. Then we will discuss the looming prospect of skyrocketing housing foreclosures and the possibility of a rash of municipal defaults that could undermine the municipal bond market and cause the next financial crisis. Economist Michael Hudson joins us. Then, as we celebrate Martin Luther King holiday, we will talk with the distinguished African-American scholar Gerald Horn, who joins us to discuss the global uprising of frustrated, angry youth reminiscent of the civil rights struggle and the relationship between Martin Luther King and American foreign policy. And then finally, on the 50th anniversary of President Eisenhower's farewell address, we'll talk with William Hartung, the author of a new book, Prophets of War, Lockheed Martin and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex. So stay tuned. Let us now turn to the situation in Tunisia. I'm speaking with Blake Hounshell, who is managing editor at Foreign Policy magazine. He joined Foreign Policy in 2006 after living in Cairo, where he studied Arabic and worked at the Ibn Khaldun Center for Development Studies. He is talking to us from Doha, Qatar. And just on Thursday in Doha, Qatar, at the meeting of the Forum for the Future, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton was talking about, and I suppose she was in a sense trying to get ahead of what was happening in Tunisia, but talked about the expectations of the young being frustrated by stagnant political order and how the money and prospects in these countries in the Middle East were being funneled to a tiny elite. What is your sense of what the Secretary of State was saying? Was she trying to preempt what was happening or about to happen in Tunisia?
Well, I think there's no question that Tunisia was on her mind. But she had just been in Yemen, which, if anything, is even worse off than Tunisia. So she might have had images from that trip on the brain as well. Either way, it was really a fortuitous thing to have said just the day before Tunisia ousted its president. It's the first time an Arab leader has been forced from office by people power in history.
And there in Qatar, with all of the leaders of the region, are some of them trembling in their boots?
No doubt. There were a lot of this is the foreign ministers, but either way, the leaders of countries like Egypt, Algeria, Libya had to be nervous as they are watching things unfold in Tunisia. Actually, there was a really interesting, sort of bizarre speech by Muammar Gaddafi, the Libyan leader, last night, who said that Tunisians were impatient. They should have just waited 3 years for Ben Ali's term to expire, and they should have kept him because he was the best leader in Africa, as Gaddafi put it.
Gaddafi is throwing his credibility in quotes behind this disgraced leader who was roundly hated by his people. And according to these WikiLeaks documents, the U.S. government was saying the guy's totally out of touch with his people.
And, that was absolutely right. It seemed like, to the very end, he didn't really have a good, sense of what was going on the Tunisian street. And he let his wife and his wife's family get away with a lot of just really gross excesses. And that really angered people who were dealing with high unemployment. One of the ironies of the Tunisian situation is Ben Ali actually did a pretty decent job of building an education system. But the problem is when you educate people but you're not able to find jobs for them, they find ways of expressing their grievances. And it ultimately led to his ouster. The sort of gap between their expectations and what he was able to provide for them economically.
Again, I'm speaking with the managing editor of Foreign Policy magazine, Blake Hounshell, who is in Qatar in the Middle East, and where Secretary of State Hillary Clinton last Thursday to some extent preempted events in Tunisia by suggesting that the region's foundations are sinking into the sand. And it does seem, though, Blake Hounshell, that we perhaps, you know, are too Eurocentric or America-centric in terms of our analysis sometimes. For example, I understand the White House was quite shocked by the demonstrations in Pakistan in favor of the bodyguard who shot the progressive governor of the state of Punjab. And I understand that, the main kind of narrative that we have about Tunisia is in many ways, you know, that it is has created a fairly big middle class, but it's also been popular with Western investors, but not with the people on the street. And this revolution was sparked by a young man who was college educated, who couldn't get a job except selling fruit on a street corner, and the much hated police hassled him, confiscated his fruit, and left him, a penniless because he was supposed to have the license. But obviously there was, you know, probably angling for a bribe there. Who knows? But the long and the short is the kid immolated himself, and that became the spark for this revolution.
Well, you know, that's just exactly the kind of thing that world events turn on. It's not something that analysts are very good at predicting historically. But I do think people who are watching Tunisia, you know, closely were warning about this sort of thing, not only U.S. diplomats in the cables, but also outside analysts. I remember reading an op-ed in The Guardian in November warning that Tunisia was on the brink of something. I didn't really note it at the time, but in hindsight, it seemed like a warning sign worth paying attention to.
But it did seem, though, that there was a kind of a Wizard of Oz quality to this coup, that the leader had been in there for 23 years, and it seemed like he was sort of delusional. When he gave his last television address, he was sitting there trying to make excuses for himself, and the phone kept ringing, and there was nobody to answer the phone. He eventually had to answer the phone. It was just pathetic.
Yeah, well, you know, this is what happens to leaders. The older they get, the longer they stay in power. He'd been there for 23 years and was heavily involved in the state before then. I remember reading something today that was quite fascinating about when people were tearing down posters of him in Tunis. They were peeling back layer after layer of posters of Ben Ali, and it actually seemed like he was getting older the further you peeled back the layers, because he was so vain. He had all of his wrinkles airbrushed and his hair dyed as he got older.
I see. Well, what is your sense, Blake Hounshell, again, the managing editor of Foreign Policy magazine, who is in Doha, Qatar, in the Persian Gulf, where the foreign ministers of the Middle Eastern countries are meeting, and where Secretary of State Hillary Clinton gave an address last Thursday that apparently shook up a lot of the Arab leaders there in attendance. There is, however, a sort of something of an echo of Condoleezza Rice in this, and I'm just wondering about – now, obviously, Hillary Clinton and this administration aren't these reckless utopian neocons, don't seem to have a lot of traction, mercifully, with this government. But the notion that happened during the Bush era that we were spreading democracy in the Middle East, the consequences are, I think, at least worth thinking about. What happens when Mubarak falls? And there's an experience that right next door to Tunisia or Algeria, of course, we experienced what happened there when the feast, the Islamists were poised to win power. And the notion was that in some parts of the Arab world, particularly with Islamists, it's one vote, one time, and that's it. Now, that led to a bloody civil war. So Is Hillary Clinton repeating some of the kind of reckless utopianism of the Bush neocons? In terms of realpolitik, in other words, I'm not placing any moral judgments
sure.
here.
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think you know the State Department and Obama's statements have been fairly cautious. It's not like we called for the U.S. government called for Ben Ali's ouster all along. I think it was really about you know calling on the Tunisian government to respect the rights and will of the Tunisian people, and demanding, you know, free and fair elections. But there was a point, actually, the day before that Hillary Clinton gave that speech, that she said, we're not going to take sides. So I don't think the U.S. government has really been sort of radical on this, calling for a revolution across the Middle East. And I actually don't think, you know, a regime like Egypt, they might be worried tonight. They might be, you know, watching scenes in Tunis and nervously trying to put their finger on the pulse of their own population. But Egypt does have a pretty good sense of how to let the population blow off steam. They've been playing the authoritarian game pretty well for the last few decades and weathered a lot of different storms, including, you know, the famous assassination of Anwar Sadat. So they've been through a lot, and they really know how to hold on to power, for better or worse.
Well, on the other side of the coin, in terms of these popular movements, particularly with the frustrated young who are educated, and as you mentioned, Tunisia was unique in terms of its education and its burgeoning middle class, and of all the countries, that should have been the one where we were urging for more political freedom, because then it would have been more of a model. And now there's a power vacuum and a lot of uncertainty, and the army is basically holding it together, and the police are despised. Now we know that a lot of young Egyptians have been demonstrating in front of the Tunisian embassy in Cairo, saying Mubarak will be next. So, given the viral nature of this revolt through the use of Facebook and other social networks, and the role that Al Jazeera has been playing, giving accurate information, showing the kind of pictures that have been routinely censored in the Arab world, don't you think that all these regimes are riding a tiger by the tail?
Well, you know, there's no question that they're just facing these incredible challenges, and they've done a miserable job of providing, you know, well-being and security to their people. I think I read recently that if you look at the last decade and you take all Arab countries, they've grown at a rate of half a percentage point over the last decade. And that includes, you know, this massive oil boom that we've witnessed. So they're really sort of staring stagnation in the face. But having said that, they're pretty adept at staying in power. They know how to you know, to crack down when they need to crack down, and how to let the population you know, have a little breathing space when that might help as well. In, you know, take a place like Egypt. You mentioned those demonstrations outside the Tunisian embassy. Well, it sounds like it might have been a lot of people, but you have to remember, Egypt is a country of 80 million people. You talk about Facebook and Twitter. Well, half of the Egyptian public is illiterate, and that's really the, you know, the main support base of the ruling party, the NDP. There, they have a massive patronage system, and they can use it to get the poor on their side, who, ironically, you know, would probably be better off in a democratic system. But, you know, bread talks, money talks, and that's how these regimes have stayed in power for so long.
Well, just in closing, in the last minute, then Blake Hanschel, given that what happened with the feast in Algeria, and apparently the Algerian regime is nervous at the moment about what's happening next door. How does the U.S. craft a foreign policy, to take Hillary Clinton at her word, that does encourage democracy in places like Tunisia, that is largely secular? as opposed to what happened in Iran, where you have a democracy but with a theocratic overlay. So, and Saudi Arabia is a sort of theocracy and certainly not a democracy, and they're obviously afraid too. So, why does it have to be this notion that if the Islamists take over, if one vote, one time, and it's all over?
Well, you know, I think we've seen even with these, you know, secular regimes, it's one vote, one time, and you sort of have to pick your poison. But I think, you know, point number one I would make is that the United States really has limited leverage. If you saw what happened in Tunisia, the U.S. really had nothing to do with it either way. So, you know, we often overestimate how much power the United States has. But also, I think the United States has been playing a reasonably smart long-term game, putting money into civil society and organizations that can help build those kinds of institutions outside of government and you know, create the kind of democratic space that will be useful in a moment of transition. I think more money should be put into those efforts, and I think the United States should be more consistent in how it you know, uses those money, those resources. We spend a lot of money on militaries in the region, and the militaries are often, you know, the instruments of repression. So I think restoring the balance and putting more money into, you know, civilian institutions and you know, being on the right side of history here will put the United States in good standing.
I thank you for joining us here today in Los Angeles, Blake Hounshell. Again, Blake Hounshell is a managing editor at Foreign Policy Magazine, and he's in Doha, Qatar. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. And then we'll now take a brief station break and return, and we'll be talking about the prospect of skyrocketing housing foreclosures and the possibility of a rash of municipal defaults that could undermine the municipal bond market and cause the next financial crisis. And welcome back to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'm speaking with Michael Hudson, who's the author of The Monster, How a Gang of Predatory Leaders and Wall Street Bankers Fleeced America and Spawned a Global Crisis. He's a staff writer at the Center for Public Integrity and previously worked as a reporter for The Wall Street Journal and as an investigator for the Center for Responsible Lending. He edited the award-winning book Merchants of Misery and appeared in the documentary film Maxed Out. Thank you for joining us today on Background Briefing, Michael Hudson.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
And Michael, you've been doing some work on the portent of a new rash of foreclosures, and I take it that there's an expectation that this year will be as bad as the peak year, which was what, 2006?
At this point, it looks, I mean, in December, you know, just last month, one out of every 500 homes in America received a foreclosure notice. So there's no evidence that the foreclosure problem is ebbing right now. We've still got a lot of problems. We still have a lot of people who are struggling. And, you know, one of the big problems is that the Obama administration's loan modification program has fallen far short of its goals. The promise was they were going to do 3 to 4 million loan modifications, help lower people's rates, not give people free houses, but just lower their monthly payments so that people who could stay in their houses could keep paying, you know, keep money flowing into the banks and the loan servicers. But just about all the evidence is that the loan modification has failed.
And what's the statistic on how many people are behind on their mortgage payments?
You know, it's a little bit hard to put an exact number on it, but it is certainly millions of homeowners at this point. And, you know, part of the problem is some people are in temporary modifications, and you don't know if they're going to come out the other side and be able to keep paying, the temporary modification is just going to be a break, and when they come back out, they're going to end up defaulting.
Again, I'm speaking with Michael Hudson, author of The Monster, How a Gang of Predatory Lenders and Wall Street Bankers Fleeced America and Spawned a Global Crisis. Well, the other crisis, and we can certainly discuss both of them in depth here, because they may be the other shoes that could drop, is that excuse me, the extent to which the municipal bond market is shaky. And as you know, Michael, that is the market where a lot of people put their money for, because it's supposed to be the safest of all investments. And now we're hearing, for example, the CEO of JP Morgan, Jamie Dimon, saying he expects to see more U.S. municipalities declare bankruptcy. And then the number one kind of guru on the market, Meredith Whitney, she's saying that this could lead to the next financial crisis as these local governments default. And she, of course, got it right about the subprime bubble, one of the few. So she's got a certain amount of credibility. And, of course, Warren Buffett is also warning the same thing. So it seems – I'd like to understand why – is it quite simply that this is about the collapse of revenues at the state and local level because of what happened on Wall Street, frankly, not as a lot of the Republicans are saying, that some of these state and local governments have been too profligate in their spending.
Right. You know, many municipalities, especially local governments, school districts, cities, depend on their revenues on property taxes. So when you have a sudden plunge in home values around the country, when you have people being foreclosed on, walking away from their houses, they're going to see their revenue crimped. So it is a big problem. But you know, I will say that no one, not even Meredith Whitney, who is very much concerned about this problem, is predicting that a single state will default or go into bankruptcy. There's really no credible expectation that that's going to happen. Now, there may be some cities, smaller municipalities that will get in trouble that may end up defaulting. But, Meredith Whitney predicted hundreds of billions in defaults in 2010. The record year for municipal defaults was about $8 billion in 2008. And it's really not credible to predict that kind of number, hundreds of billions. Joe Misak at Bloomberg News, who follows the market very closely, his prediction is maybe $5 to $10 billion in defaults, municipal bond defaults this year. Now that's a lot, but it's not an apocalyptic number.
But in the meantime, just in terms of the quality of life, in Detroit, they're cutting a lot of municipal services like trash collection and police protection. Some cities in Alabama are cutting back on the pensions. They're simply not paying the pensions they owe. Newark, New Jersey has cut 13% of its police force. Camden, New Jersey, which is a dangerous city, has begun cutting about half of its police department. So
it's true. Services are being slashed all over. I think I read that in the county where we had this horrific attack in Arizona last weekend, that mental health services had been slashed, in recent times. So that kind of tells you that all over, and the people who need help, whether it's folks with mental illnesses, folks who are struggling to pay their bills, they really can't turn to government.
Well, my understanding is, Michael Hudson, again, the author of The Monster, How a Gang of Predatory Lenders and Wall Street Bankers Fleeced America and Spawned a Global Crisis. My understanding is that one of the programs that was set up to shore up the municipal bond market and the states as well was, I think it's called Build America Bonds, BABS, and that the Republicans in the new House don't want to, in fact, didn't refund it in this deal that Obama made to get tax cuts for the rich in order to get unemployment benefits for the poor, and that there's a kind of ideological fervor in the House based upon this idea that Democratic states like Illinois and California have been profligate, and we're going to punish them. And The subtext is supposedly that the Democrats, the Republicans, also would like to break the public employees' unions, which support the Democratic Party, and also there's an element of class warfare being injected into this, where the Republicans are saying to the unemployed people in the private sector who've lost their jobs, health care, and pension, look at all those people on the public dole who've got full health care benefits, and all these state workers who nap in their trucks, etc. So do you detect any of that?
I think it's a real danger if you start seeing aid, federal aid, state governments and cities slashed. It's going to have a real cascading effect, and you might see some of these kind of defaults and really serious problems for cities around the country. It is a bit of ideological warfare, and the idea that you can tax cut your way out of a recession, it's just really not supported by history, not supported by what most economists say in terms of how the economy works and the effects of tax cuts versus the effects of government spending and stimulus.
But Michael Hudson, if these housing defaults that are in the pipeline start cascading, that means that state and local revenues will be even further decreased. And that's the heart of the problem, isn't it? Because states can't run a deficit, so they've got to pay as they go, and the money's just not coming in. And, of course, you know, the ideologues on the Republican side are not pointing out that the reason that the revenues collapsed is because of what happened on Wall Street and the devastating effect it had on our economy.
Right. The revenue problems are certainly what happened on Wall Street, what happened with the mortgage market has been a big driver in this. But I think it's also fair to say that tax cutting at the federal and state and local levels have also affected this and have also put these, you know, created the budget crunch. But I do want to say one other thing. Again, it's bad. The state and local governments are suffering, but I think sort of dire predictions of the apocalypse are not in order. Fitch Ratings, look at the debt levels of most looked at the debt levels of state and local governments and said they're actually still relatively low. Often the debt service is 10% of the budget or in many cases much less. So that it's a significant number, but it's not enough to completely bust a hole in the budget. And the idea of most cities and states, they're just not going to default. They're going to find a way to make the payments on their municipal bonds, and this may mean cutting services, which is going to hurt a lot of people.
But already the interest rates are going up, which drives up the cost of borrowing.
That's absolutely right. And state budget deficits are expected to rise from about $120 billion this year to about $140 billion over the next year. So it's a serious problem.
And the states that have the highest foreclosures, apparently, are California, Utah, Georgia, Michigan, Idaho, Illinois, and Colorado, along with Nevada, which posted the highest rate in 2010. I don't know exactly amongst those states.
And California is United. I remember I said that national figure in December.
Right.
One out of every 500 homes received a foreclosure notice. And California was one out of every 200 or so. So they're really suffering the brunt of it. And California budget crisis is serious. But I will say that it was pointed out that California has never defaulted on its debt, and that includes even back at the height of the Great Depression. So I think there's a commitment to making the payments. It's just going to be really hard to.
Well, of course, the number one state with the highest foreclosure is Nevada. Number two is Arizona, and number three is Florida.
Right.
And then California is four.
Right.
so interesting that, particularly in the case of Arizona, since it's been so much in the news, as you mentioned, they're cutting government service for mental health, and they also have the most lax gun laws in the country. But, of course, as we know, Michael, none of that had anything to do with what happened with the shooting of the congressman.
Right.
So, again, I'm speaking with Michael Hudson, author of The Monster, How a Gang of Predatory Lenders and Wall Street Bankers Fleeced America and Spawned a Global Crisis. Just in closing, what would your advice be to people? As I mentioned, you know, a lot of people look for municipal bonds as their safest investment. Should they be worried?
I think they should be worried, but I don't think they should panic. I think they should talk to their financial advisors. They should look at their portfolios. If they're in the safest municipal bonds, single A all the way up to triple A, then they should think really long and hard before they make any move and start selling off. It's important in this economy, as at any time, to really be careful and prudent about what you're doing with your investing. But don't panic. Don't go crazy. You know, it's the fear that gets going. You know, it's all about greed and fear. And when we let fear take over, we tend to make mistakes.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today in Los Angeles, Michael Hudson.
Thanks so much for having me.
Again, Michael Hudson's the author of The Monster, How a Gang of Predatory Lenders and Wall Street Bankers Fleeced America and Spawned a Global Crisis. He's a staff writer for the Center for Public Integrity and previously worked as a reporter for The Wall Street Journal and as an investigator for the Center for Responsible Lending. Let's now turn to the celebration of the 82nd, or what would have been the 82nd birthday of Martin Luther King. I'm joined by Gerald Horn, who holds the John Jay and Rebecca Moore's Chair of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston. His research has addressed issues of racism in a variety of relations involving labor, politics, civil rights, international relations, and war. He's also written extensively about the film industry, and he's written more than 24 books, including The Color of Fascism, Lawrence Dennis, Racial Passing, and the Rise of Right-Wing Extremism in the United States, The Final Victim of the Blacklist, John Howard Lawson, Dean of the Hollywood 10, and Fire This Time, The Watts Uprising and the 1960s. And thank you so much for joining us, Gerald Horn.
Thank you for inviting me.
And given we just started out talking about what happened in Tunisia, and if you saw any of the Al Jazeera footage, the young people there, frustrated, angry, but educated, not necessarily well, but educated, but no job prospects. And the whole thing was sparked by a college graduate who was selling fruit on the street corner, and the cops hassled him because he didn't have a permit, and they took away his fruit, and then he set fire to himself. So I'm trying to get a sense here of what we're seeing today as on a global scale, how it has echoes of what Martin Luther King was doing before he was assassinated.
Well, I think that's a perceptive question. It's well known that the movement that Martin Luther King came to symbolize was a movement dominated by youth. This is true for a number of reasons, not least being that youth oftentimes are dissatisfied or more dissatisfied with the status quo than their elders, and oftentimes still their elders have gotten it wrong, which sometimes is right and sometimes is wrong. Martin Luther King himself was only in his mid-20s, in the mid-1950s, when he was catapulted into prominence. You may also recall the case of Emmett Till, the young black youth from Chicago who goes to Money, Mississippi in the mid-1950s and winds up returning to Chicago in a casket after being subjected to a racist lynching. This helps to serve as a catalyst to the entire civil rights movement. And as noted, he was a young person. The four little girls who were blown up in a Birmingham church in 1963 in the same neighborhood in which Condoleezza Rice and Angela Davis were born and came to prominence. This bombing also was a catalyst for the movement because the snuffing out of their lives was seen, like the snuffing out of the life of a 9-year-old girl in Tucson, Arizona, the past week, as a particularly heinous crime. The shock troops of the civil rights movement, those who were in the forefront of the sit-ins and the swim-ins and the read-ins of segregated public libraries, was the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, mostly teenagers and college youth, who were oftentimes more fearless than their counterparts of age. If you look at the counterpart of SNCC, the Students for a Democratic Society, who played such a pivotal role not only in the anti-war movement but in the civil rights movement, likewise, these are younger people. Berkeley 1964, which kicks off this entire student movement, mostly teenagers and young people. So it is accurate to draw a line from what's going on in Tunisia, which similarly involves the uprising of young people, and what happened in the United States, particularly in the Deep South, beginning in the 1950s.
And again, I'm speaking with historian Gerald Horn, author of The Fire This Time, The Watts Uprising, and the 1960s. And given the personal tragedy, if you will, of LBJ's and his presidency, and the recognition, however belated, that the war in Vietnam consumed his presidency and foreclosed the war on poverty and all of the attempts at reforms, which were haven't been seen since, frankly. And I recall, of course, that interestingly enough, that even though that's what happened to LBJ, and I think he historians and he certainly know it, Martin Luther King, when he started to make comparisons between the war on poverty at home and the war in Vietnam, taking all the treasury and you can't have guns and butter, he got castigated, didn't he?
Oh, absolutely. He was denounced by some of our more prestigious editorial boards at our leading newspapers. It was said that he was stepping out of line by veering into the realm of foreign policy. We should long remember and little forget his famous speech that he gave at Riverside Church in Upper Manhattan in April 1967, where he basically laid down a gauntlet, not only in the feet of the LBJ administration, but before the U.S. people themselves, basically telling them that you cannot have guns and butter, that it's very difficult for Dr. King to go to his constituency and try to tell them about the virtues of nonviolence, while, as he put it, the U.S. government was one of the greatest purveyors of violence in the world today. And I think we should also remember that there's a particular Pacifica connection, because one of the closest advisors to Dr. King was Jack O'Dell, a former chairman of the board of the Pacifica Foundation, now in retirement in Vancouver, British Columbia, reaching his 80s, perhaps his early 90s by now. And it was John F. Kennedy himself who took Dr. King into the Rose Garden of the White House, presumably to evade the prying ears and wiretaps of the FBI, to tell Dr. King that he should basically oust Jack O'Dell because of Jack's supposed left-wing credentials and connections. And Dr. King formally did so, but actually kept a sort of underground connection to Jack and continued to receive his counsel. And I think that this is a kind of history, sadly, that has been forgotten, not least as we begin to mark the 82nd birthday of Dr. King.
And Gerald Horn, in terms of Martin Luther King and foreign policy, surely the civil rights movement did have a foreign policy component, in as much as that we were trying to capture the moral high ground in the Cold War, and the Soviets, on the other hand, would say, "Well, how can you?" Spread democracy in Africa, for example, when you limit it to your own African-Americans at home?
You put your finger on a very important point. It is precisely that dynamic, historians such as myself and other historians have argued, is the key to unlock the apparent mystery of why Jim Crow began to fall when it did. That is to say that the United States certainly had problems in pointing to itself as a paragon of human rights virtue in the Cold War battle with Moscow, when it tolerated such atrocious activity and behavior towards its own citizens. And out of that dynamic, you began to see the erosion of the more excessive and egregious aspects of U.S.-style apartheid. But I think it's important to recognize, and this is going to be the subject of a soon-to-be-published book of my own, that this dynamic, this connection between the domestic and the international did not just begin in the 1950s during the Cold War. Indeed, if you look at the founding of the United States itself in the latter part of the 18th century, I think it's very curious that at the same time the United States was being founded, there was an abolitionist movement taking flight in Great Britain. And the abolitionist movement, that is to say the movement to abolish slavery, basically reached its apex in London at a time when the United States was becoming one of the greatest slave empires that the world had ever known. This led to London constantly castigating the United States for its pretensions towards democracy at the same time it was tolerating slavery. And I dare say that that dynamic played a role in terms of the erosion of support for slavery. And certainly when Abraham Lincoln issued his Emancipation Proclamation on January 1st, 1863, one of the essential reasons he did so was not only because of some sort of morality concerning enslaved Africans, but also he wanted to keep abolitionist Britain on side. That is to say, there was a danger that London would tip the scales in favor of the Confederacy, the so-called Confederate States of America, that launched the Civil War for the principle and purpose of keeping Africans in bonds. And by issuing the Emancipation Proclamation, Mr. Lincoln was able to show a meaningful distinction between the blue and the gray, between Washington and Richmond, and that helped to tip the scales, basically staying the hand of London in terms of possibly intervening on the side of the Confederate States of America. So I dare say that throughout the history of this republic, there has been a close tie between the domestic and the global, not least when it comes to human rights.
Well, of course, Gerald Horne, the great tragedy of the Cold War was, since quite simply the reason we had a Cold War was we couldn't afford to have a hot war, and in effect the two superpowers, the Soviets and the United States, took out their frustrations at this stalemate through the surrogate wars, and particularly on the continent of Africa, which have led to much of the problems today. And of course now we have the largest country in Africa, Sudan, splitting in two with an extremely uncertain future, with a great likelihood of civil war.
Uncertain future indeed. It was oftentimes said during the Cold War that what prevented a Third World War was war in the Third World. And there is certainly something to that aphorism. At the same time, I think that it's important for we of the United States to recall that that particular dynamic also led to a process that catapulted the present occupant of the White House into the chair that he now holds. What I'm saying is that when the so-called Mau Mau revolt erupted in Kenya in the early 1950s, there was fear and apprehension in Washington about where this struggle was leading. This was taking place at a time when Moscow had diplomatic relations with neighboring Ethiopia and was beginning a campaign to try to attract African students to the then Soviet Union to study. This led directly to the airlift that led Barack Obama Sr. to travel from Kenya, winding up at the University of Hawaii, where he meets, as we know, Stanley Dunham, and the rest is history in terms of their producing a child who now occupies the White House. So there are many different aspects to the Cold War in Africa and African Americans that I think are worth exploring.
Well, just in closing, Gerald Horne, again, I'm speaking with historian Gerald Horne, author of The Fire This Time, The Watts Uprising, and The 1960s. Just back to the domestic arena, if you will, and it seems to me that you mentioned the shooting in Arizona, and we've just been talking about Martin Luther King, of course, who was assassinated, and he joins a sort of pantheon of American martyrs, some of the most talented and interesting people this country's produced, like Jack and Bobby Kennedy, Martin Luther King. And it was so extraordinary that the tragedy up in Arizona touched some really impressive people. This congresswoman turns out to be a really impressive woman. Her husband's an impressive man, an astronaut. Her brother-in-law is up there in space running the space station. And this young 9-year-old girl was an extraordinary young girl, as the president so eloquently described. And then you contrast that with the assassins, these tormented people like Sirhan Sirhan and this fellow in Arizona. And it seems to me that there really is a sort of a dark and a light side in this country.
Well, I'm afraid so. And since you're speaking of assassins, we should not fail to mention James Earl Ray, who was charged with the assassination of Martin Luther King, although a congressional committee raised grave doubts about whether or not he acted alone. But in any case, when we talk about assassinations, we should not fail to forget the fact that there is a long history, I'm afraid, of political murder and political assassination in this country. We should also recall that this is a society, I'm afraid, that's suffused with violence. At last count, there are probably as many guns in this country or as there are human beings, something that appalls our peers, particularly in Western Europe. But I think that what helps to distinguish the United States, perhaps from some of its peers, is that the United States also has a long history of chattel slavery. And in order to get people to work for free for hundreds of years, you have to basically employ violence in a promiscuous fashion. And I think that as long as we tend to obscure or ignore such salient facts, we'll be left scratching our heads about these kinds of tragedies that unfold with all too frequent regularity in places like Tucson, Arizona.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today in Los Angeles, Gerald Horn, on this, what would have been the 87th birthday of Dr. Martin Luther King.
Thank you for inviting me.
And again, I was speaking then with Gerald Horn, who holds the John Jay and Rebecca Morse Chair of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston. He has written more than 24 books, including The Color of Fascism, Lawrence Dennis, Racial Passing, and The Rise of Right-Wing Extremism in the United States, The Final Victims of the Blacklist, John Howard Lawson, Dean of the Hollywood 10, and Fire This Time, The Watts Uprising, and the 1960s. Let's take a brief station break and return in a moment and discuss one of the largest legacies of the military-industrial complex 50 years on from Martin Luther King. And I'd like to also announce that James Lawson, who worked with Martin Luther King, will be hosting a weekly program here every Friday at 2 p.m. on KPFK. And welcome back to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'm speaking with William Hartung, who's the author of a new book, Prophets of War, Lockheed Martin and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex. Thank you for joining us here today on, tomorrow will be the 50th anniversary of President Eisenhower's farewell address, where he coined that phrase, the military-industrial complex.
Yes, that's right. Thanks for having me.
And Prophets of War, of course, I must point out, is spelled P-R-O-P-H-E-T-S, Prophets of War, Lockheed Martin, and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex. And what is it about Lockheed Martin that you obviously feel, William Hartung, encapsulates the military-industrial complex?
Well, part of it is just the sheer size. It gets about $30 billion a year in Pentagon contracts, about one out of every $14 the Pentagon hands out for those purposes. It's involved in a much wider range of activities than anything Eisenhower could have imagined, not just making weapons, but they have hired interrogators for Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib. They've sort of run their own foreign policy, doing things like helping reform the justice system in Liberia, helping write the Afghan constitution, recruiting election monitors in the Ukraine and Bosnia. So in addition to their kind of weapons portfolio, they've reached into many other aspects of our lives and our foreign policy of a sort that Eisenhower probably would be very surprised to hear about.
And when Secretary Gates talks about cutting the military budget, $200 billion in this time of austerity, where a lot of people are talking about cutting Social Security, which actually pays for itself, where clearly military spending even though it's sold in the name of jobs, any economist will tell you it's one of the worst multipliers in terms of jobs.
Yes. Well, interesting, the Gates proposal is a little bit of bait and switch because he's going to take about $100 billion of that, plow it right back into the Pentagon, probably mostly the weapons procurement that will help companies like Lockheed Martin. Then what's left is about 1% or so of the record-level budget. So I think the companies will definitely rally against this and against any further cuts, but they're really getting almost a free ride in terms of the overall budget situation and the kinds of cuts that are being talked about for domestic programs.
Well, it seems extremely coincidental, shall we say, William Hartung, that the minute that Gates started to talk about cutting the defense budget, suddenly there are all these articles in the paper about China's blue water navy and its new ground-to-sea missile and its stealth fighter. Do you find those stories suspicious?
Well, I think, you know, there's a couple things about them. One, I think they overstate China's actual capabilities. The other thing is, you know, it's sort of the Colin Powell maxim. After the end of the Cold War, he said, I'm running out of enemies here. And I think China is the new enemy that the whole, you know, the Pentagon, the military companies, the military industrial complex, if you will, are sort of hoping for, looking for, to try to justify projects that might otherwise, you know, not make any sense if you're talking about fighting Al-Qaeda or other kinds of threats to the United States.
So what's going on, though, in terms of this sort of zombie-type situation with the military-industrial complex, where once they get a weapon system going, and no matter how flawed it is and no matter how much the cost overruns, they just keep going and going and going, and then they start they just won't stop the production lines. The C-130, you know, I think at one point John McCain said, you know, we could park them as mascots in front of high schools. There's so many of them. The same thing's happening with its replacement, the C-19. It just goes on.
Well, a lot of it is the fault of the Congress, you know, in collusion with the contractors. The C-130, which is a Lockheed Martin product, started in the 50s, and in the last decade or more, most of the ones that have been bought have been added on by the Congress, not requested by the Pentagon. So places like Marietta, Georgia, the Georgia delegation, places where the things are deployed, like in Mississippi and elsewhere, those members are really the ones that have been pushing this. And the Pentagon's attitude is, well, you know, if you're going to give it to us, I guess we'll take it.
So what do you think about the given Eisenhower's prescience 50 years ago in his farewell address? And I think historians would agree that Eisenhower was furious with what happened with his attempts to end the Cold War with Khrushchev. They were poised to Eisenhower was going to visit the Soviet Union after Khrushchev had visited here, and they'd had a good rapport, and Khrushchev was even building a golf course for Ike down in on the Black Sea. And then the U-2 incident happens and blows it all out of the water. And Eisenhower was furious because the CIA promised him that there'd be no evidence, and suddenly this pilot shows up, and Eisenhower was humiliated. And frankly, Khrushchev was trapped. He couldn't back down, so he had to basically blow up the Paris peace talks, and the Cold War went on for decades more.
Well, the CIA was pushing these flights to some degree with Eisenhower's resistance. He really felt they were too risky, that the possibility of something like the Gary Powers incident outweighed any benefits they could get in terms of intelligence. So I think, you know, partly the fingerprints of the CIA, partly some people around him who gave him bad advice. And, of course, the companies couldn't have been happier because, you know, going too far in terms of a rapprochement or a detente would have undermined things like the missile gap, the bomber gap, all the kind of myths that helped fuel the Kennedy buildup in the early 60s.
So I was going to suggest, though, that as bad as the military-industrial complex has proven, and as much of a drain on the Treasury, there's been a whole new layer since Bush and Cheney of this contractor phenomenon, and the privatization of so many government activities, not just in Department of Defense, but throughout the entire government. Do you think that given that adjunct to the military-industrial complex, that the tentacles are just so deeply enmeshed that it'll be next to impossible to undo them?
Well, I think the whole use of private contractors like Blackwater, which is now known as ZXE, to try to get away from their history, I guess, the Halliburton examples, the fact that you've got more private contractors working for the CIA than you do government employees, it is pervasive. And I think, you know, if it were to be rolled back, it would be a multi-year project, and it would take you know, a lot of fortitude on the part of a president who really made it a top priority. So I don't foresee it certainly in the short term happening, because you would need to develop the expertise within government that is kind of outsourced to all these other companies. And, of course, some of it is for things that we may not need to do in the first place.
Again, I'm speaking with William Hartung, who's the director of the Arms and Security Initiative at the New American Foundation and the author of this brand new book, Prophets of War, Lockheed Martin and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex. And we're speaking on the 50th anniversary of President Eisenhower's farewell address in 1960. As you know, William, the pharmaceutical companies have been able to advertise on television, and it has been an enormous boom for them. They advertise all these drugs, Cialis, endlessly. You got these two people in a bathtub. I don't quite follow that, but that's another matter. You've got the phenomenon there. The more they advertise, the more people ask for drugs from their doctors, and it's proven to be tremendously successful. I've also noticed that for the first time ever, these big contractors are now advertising on television, telling us how patriotic they are and how much they care about America's fighting men and women. And it strikes me as being equally as pernicious as the drug companies. And at some point I'm saying to myself, well, why can't somebody intervene here? They're selling themselves based upon taxpayer money, and I thought that was illegal.
Well, I think they've circumvented it because they argue that, you know, they're not using their government profits to do it. But most of these companies are essentially wards of the state. I mean, Lockheed Martin gets 80 to 90% of its revenue from tax dollars. So it's hard to imagine that this money is not, you know, directly or indirectly coming from there. But I haven't seen, you know, much uproar in the Congress or certainly the Pentagon about this. And I think if somebody looked closely, it may well be illegal, but you know, I don't think anybody's done any pushback on it. And for the companies, to some degree, they're selling themselves. You know,
sure. Well, I'm afraid we've run out of time here today. I thank you so much for joining us, William Hartung, again, and for your new book, Prophets of War, Lockheed Martin and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex.
Thanks very much.
And I'd also like to invite you, the audience here, to join me at the Hammer Museum on January the 27th at 7 o'clock for a free public forum on Afghanistan, America's Longest War. I'll be moderating a discussion with anthropologist Thomas Barfield and Afghan broadcaster Spasmai Maywandi. You can join me there Thursday, January the 27th at 7 p.m., free and open to the public. And I'd like to thank producer Spencer Downing, engineer Devin Jordan. I'm not sure I'll be on tomorrow at 5. If there's any special Martin Luther King programming, I'm not certain whether or not that will be happening. Otherwise, I'll be on Tuesday. Bye for now.